Joan Scox. This is Bill Cook. We are going to be in a hurry for the next 90 minutes because we actually created a presentation that was much, much longer than this and then had to go through and go, we only have 90 minutes, and it's killing us. It's killing us that what we're able to cover today is just some of the basic stuff like why you should buy more rentals and why you should buy them without using your cash and credit. And we're going to give away the biggest secret to doing that, like what you have to have. It's not very difficult. What you have to have in order to do that, and we're going to be able to take a reasonably deep dive into a couple of the strategies, okay, to just kind of get you some ideas about what you could go out and do. What we can't cover is whether you will do it or not, because we've been teaching creative finance strategies together and separately for a lot of years now, and we've seen a lot of people who have been really interested and really fascinated, come to the classes, read the books, talked about it, and then never actually made an offer to anyone that would have allowed them to get a rental with no cash or credit. We certainly can't cover every strategy that you can use to do it, and honestly, it kind of drives us nuts that we couldn't schedule 12 hours here at the convention to go into everything that we wanted to. So he and I agreed that we are going to deliver more to you over the course of the weekend. Number one, you need to be at this How I Bought My Last Rental Without Cash or Credit. It is not a panel discussion. It is four of the attendees, and actually I think Kyle's here right now. I saw Michelle earlier. These are just like folks who went out and did it, and they're going to talk about, they all did different kinds of deals, and they're going to talk about them and answer questions for you about anything you want to know for an hour and a half. On Saturday at 2:30, he and I have a question and answer session scheduled in Fallen Timbers right across the hallway. So sorry, that's at 2 o'clock. We'll have an hour and a half where you can just like pepper us with questions. So if there's something, some deal we talk about today or something that you're like, oh, I wonder how this happened, definitely come to that Q&A session. Either Bill or I will be in the bookstore pretty much all the time. So if you have like, oh, I have this deal I'm working on types of questions, you can come and ask them there. And we are also going to deliver everything you want here by encouraging you to join the Ultimate Creative Deal Structuring Community, which, trust me, you will hear more about that toward the end. So let's start with the why are we here, right? Like, why did you bother to crowd into this class on this particular day? Why do you, I'm not asking like in general, why do people, I'm asking you specifically, why do you want to own more rentals than you do right now?
For
retirement income?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, passive income.
For passive income?
Financial freedom.
For financial freedom?
Spend more time with
For tax benefits?
Spend more time with his kids.
Spend more time with your kids? To do what? For inheritance, for generational wealth. Yeah, that's a good one. So what I'm hearing is a combination between benefits I might get right now, like tax benefits, and benefits that I'm going to get later, like retirement income and generational wealth. So, yeah, there's the now. There's the I can have extra money in my life right now, and there's the tax breaks that I can have right now, depending on the structure I set up. And yeah, that's true. And I'm gonna start with an example here, okay? And he and I are going to be talking about the same two examples throughout the presentation. So you might want to like take some notes on the numbers here, because next time we talk about this one, it's going to be about why would the seller do this, okay? So this is a house here in Cincinnati. It is a triplex. It is in Norwood, Ohio, which puts it about three blocks from a private university called Xavier University, which gives me a built-in set of tenants, right? It also has a really good unit mix. It has a three-bedroom on the second and third floor. It has a two-bedroom on the second floor. And then there's what the seller called a garden apartment. It's in the basement. That is an efficiency unit. Okay, so you've got the picture here. The gross rent on this building is $2,850 a month. The operating expenses are $912. So that includes taxes, insurance, maintenance, vacancy, and we do pay water because it's only got one water meter for the whole building. The tenants pay their other utilities. So $912 a month in operating expenses. What do operating expenses not include? The mortgage payment, right? Like the monthly debt service payment. The monthly debt service payment is $1,500 a month. So do some quick math in your head and tell me, since we're talking about what can these do for you now, is that going to create income now? Yeah, here, let me help you out. It's $438 a month net right now. $438 a month. Could you use that?
Yes.
If you had 10 of these, could you use $4,380 a month?
Yes.
If you had 20, could you see how this works? Okay. So there's another part to this that we talked about, though. There's the now, and then there's the thing that it is really hard for us to think about, which is what does a deal look like 20 years up the road? We all too often analyze deals by going, whoa, it doesn't cash flow right now, and we're not looking at what happens 20 years up the road. Later on, these properties generate even more cash flow. Why? Because rents go up, and because eventually you own it free and clear, right? There's no mortgage. That's the biggest show. I mean, if I had to not pay $1,500 a month, I'd be making a lot more money, right? Also, so lots and lots of cash flow, and the goal here is be an ender. Who can tell me what an ender is?
Someone who's in these, they're just basically free and clear.
They're free and clear.
No longer have to work to make a living.
Your assets are paying for your lifestyle, not your work paying for your lifestyle. So, you know, when I talk, I don't care how new a real estate investor is. I don't care if they're like, oh, I want to wholesale houses. When I ask them what their ultimate goal is, one way or another, they say to be an ender. They say, I want my real estate assets to support me and everything I want to do for the entire rest of my life and not work anymore. That's what they say. The other thing that you get later when you start to pay off the property is equity, which in real estate, that's how we say wealth. I'm worth $1 million. What does that mean? I have $1 million in equity. Maybe that's generational wealth. Maybe you pass that on to your kids and they keep a hold of it and it creates cash flow and enderhood for them. It also creates borrowing power, right? Free and clear properties are very easy to borrow against if you need some money, and it creates an emergency fund for your old age. Now, the goal is never sell a property, right? But if you were told you needed a head transplant and your insurance didn't want to cover that for some reason, I guess it would really be a body transplant, wouldn't it? Can you sell houses? Can you sell houses to pay for stuff like that? Sure. Example.
And several people have come up to me and they said, I thought Vina was taller than you, Bill. I want you to know that she is not wearing shoes. I'm wearing cowboy boots with a 1-inch heel. Yes, Vina is taller than me. This is not real. So, Kim wants to take a picture.
Picture, and of course, the thing you messed up.
And then we'll talk about Prater Drive.
Yes, I think it'd be a really great idea. Okay, so let's talk about Prater Drive. How many people in here have been investing for more than 20 years? Raise your hand. Keep your hands up for a second. How many of us did deals 20 years ago that were marginal at best, and today we look like geniuses? Keep your hands up. Okay, so time, when you do investing, one of the things that's important is you want to look forward to the deal. Use forward-looking glasses, magic glasses that allow you to look at that house 10 or 20 years from now, not just this week or next week. Look forward to this deal. Is it a good home? Is it a good neighborhood? Good churches, good schools, good area town, close to your home, easy to get to. So it's that, it's very important. So in 2021, Kim and I bought a house on Prater Drive. And it was a no money.
2001, not 2021.
Is that what I said?
Yes.
Don't listen to what I actually say. You have to correct me as I go. So in 2001, Kim and I bought this property, and it was a no-money down deal, and we did not have to qualify for a mortgage. The payments on it were $560 a month, and the rent would be about $750 a month. Now, this may look, who are the people who have never owned rental property? Raise your hand. Okay, this may look like there's some cash flow here. Those of you that are experienced landlords, is there any cash flow here? No, because you have to remember the rental property, it's not just a principal and interest payment. You have taxes, insurance, vacancies, repairs, and management. You have to include other stuff. So can you see that there is absolutely no cash flow in this deal? Everybody see that? Okay, so there we go. The fair market value in this property is $75,000. Our purchase price was $73,000. Is there any equity?
No.
Why do you say there's no equity? What expenses do we have if we decided to sell this property right away? You have to pay your realtor. We have to pay some closing costs. So do you see there's no equity? There's no cash flow in this deal. Everybody see that? Okay. Why do this deal? There's a seat right here, ma'am. And one right there, ma'am. Why do this deal? Someone tell me.
You love the neighborhood.
In the end, it's not costing us anything, is it? It's not going to cost us anything. So who's going to pay this home for off for us one day? Our tenants, our residents. They're going to be kind enough to pay this off. So that's why I do this deal. I want you to go forward 21 years. Kim and I still own this home. And today, that home has a value of $190,000. Is that more than $75,000?
Yes.
So the equity came in time. Also, the gross rent on this home is now $1,400 per month. Is that better than the $750 we were getting back in 2001?
Yes.
That's a whole lot better. So it's producing $1,000 a month after all the expenses are taken into. It's giving us $1,000 a month. You heard Vina talk about as far as to be financially free. You want to have the cash flow coming in. You want your capital assets working for you rather than you working on your capital assets. So what does this give us? And I want you to think from your point of view. $1,000 a month coming on this house. How many of these do you need for you to be an ender? An ender doesn't mean you're dead. An ender doesn't mean you're not doing deals. That just means you don't need to go to work anymore in order to cover your bills and your lifestyle and the things that you do. That's what that means. So to be an ender, how many houses is it going to take you, your situation? How many do you need? The second question is, this house is now worth nearly $200,000. How many of these do you need? How many of these do you need before you're a multimillionaire?
He just walks off stage. All right, so y'all probably were already convinced you needed to have rentals so you wouldn't be here. Why do you need to have rentals that you didn't get use your own cash or credit to get? Because you can get more of them.
Infinite return on investment.
Because your return on investment when your investment is zero is really, really high. Like if you're making $7 a month, your return on $0 is still infinite, right? Anything else? Say again? Keep your capital for reserves. It's quicker. Anything else? Really, no one's going to fess up to that they don't have cash or credit to buy rentals with? Because I can tell you that is exactly the position I was in when I bought my first rental property. I mean, I was just out of college. My balance sheet was a negative number. Yeah, my now ex-husband had about $70,000 in student loans, which didn't get forgiven. Because, you know, we had to pay him off back then. So, we were each making $18,000 a year. There was no money. There was no credit. There was no, like, it was either buy without cash or credit or don't buy. So, some reasons might be because I don't have any. But even if you do, those things are both limited resources. If I handed you $1 million right now and said, go buy rentals, you would run out of money after about 5 rentals if you paid cash for them. And even if all you did was put 20% down, you would still run out of money quicker than you would run out of properties you wanted to buy. And also, you all know that with conventional loans, you can't get more than 10. It doesn't matter how good your credit is. You can't get an 11th conventional loan. If you want an 11th one, you got to go to a portfolio lender, and then you're paying adjustable rates, and you know, all kinds of bad stuff happens after 10. So limited resources, which means they always having to depend on using cash and credit, will stunt the speed at which you can become an ender. You will just run across roadblocks in terms of buying the next asset. Now, the other thing is, there are some deals that if you have to go to the bank and put down money and borrow money, the deal just doesn't work. Like, the deal doesn't make sense if you have to do it that way. And actually, Williams is a good example of this. Let's think about if I had bought this property today and I had gone to the bank to borrow the money. I will share that my purchase price is $180,000. We'll go through more of these numbers a little bit later. How much money as an investor do I have to put down to get that loan? 20% plus closing costs, and that's if I'm in my first four loans. If I'm in number 5 through 10, I'm putting down 25% plus closing costs, right? So I would have to come to the closing with $45,000. You can't usually do that too many times in a row, right? You might be able to do it once or once every couple of years. I put down zero. Is zero better than $45,000 in
your... How are you able to put down zero and still buy a house?
I will explain that, Bill. Also, I checked on bankrate.com today to look at what investor rates are right now, and they're ranging from 8 to 8.675% interest. So I put down my $45,000, which means my loan is only $135,000. But at 8.625% interest, my payment is $1,641 principal, interest, taxes, and insurance on this house. I'm paying $1,500. Is that better?
Yeah.
If I had to buy it with the bank, my cash flow would only be $297 a month versus $438. And my cash-on-cash return, if I went to the bank and did this thing, would be about 7.9%. $297 a month on a $45,000 investment, that's about 7.9%. What I did instead was put down zero and get $498 a month. And you're free to get out your financial calculators and do the division and say, okay, $498 times 12, how much annual cash flow is that, divided by zero. And then your calculator is going to say, nope, can't do that, because it is an infinite rate of return. So, enough examples. Yeah, great, you guys did that. Do you want to know the big secret of how to do it?
Yes.
Right, most of them don't know.
I know.
Let's skip the next 5 slides because they don't want to know.
Eight people want to know.
Do you want to know the big secret?
Yes.
Oh, okay. The big secret is people. Lots and lots of people. Everywhere you look in one of these deals, there are people. There are not institutions, there are human beings. The first person is always going to be you, right? The first person in any creative deal you do is always going to be you. In order to do these successfully, you have to decide for yourself if a series of things are true. Number one is, do you want to do creative deal structures?
Yes.
Number two, do you actually believe that they are doable if you have the right knowledge? I know you might, right now you might be like, oh, I don't know how to do it, but do you see people around you who are doing these deals and you're going, I'm just as smart as they are. If I had their knowledge, I could do it too.
Yes.
Okay. The third thing is, you have to be committed to getting the knowledge even when it's hard.
Yes.
And we're not gonna pull your leg here. Learning creative deal structures is not like learning wholesaling, where all you have to do is learn how to multiply the ARV times 0.7 and subtract the repair costs, okay? There's a lot more moving parts in a creative deal structure, and there are some times when you're going to feel like frustrated about it, like, I can't get this. I'll tell you what that was for me. Wrap mortgages. I could not get my head around wrap mortgages to save my life. Like, it took me eight trips through the course to even understand what they were and how they worked. And I spent a lot of time going, am I stupid? Like, why am I not getting this? There are times when you're going to feel that way, but you will ultimately get it. Here's a big one. You can have a PhD in creative deal structuring and still have no money. Because once you know how to do the things, you have to go out and put them in front of people, right? You have to actually make offers. You have to talk to folks and say, hey, would this solve your problem? Taking action is the real difference between the people who study it and don't get anything out of it and people who study it and become enders. And the other thing is, you got to be really serious about making win-win deals for you and everyone else in the transaction, because when you start to see these strategies, when you start to see the techniques, and you start to learn how to talk to people about it, it becomes kind of like this magic power. Like, you're suggesting to people stuff that they, to sellers, for instance, something that they've never heard of. They don't know what a subject to is, but here you are trying to, you're saying, I can take over your mortgage payments and you'll never have to make another one. And if you aren't serious about making that a win-win deal, and you don't have the seller protected in that deal, and you haven't done a deal that you can actually perform on, you can really hurt other people with these strategies. And that's why you work so hard to get the knowledge. But if you're serious about, actually, I'm gonna make sure everybody in every deal is happy, good, have the best outcome, then you'll do really well. In fact, if you will bother to learn this stuff and then go implement it, you will be an ender faster than anybody else that you know. Because most people do not know this stuff, they do not go out and implement it. So first people is you, got it? Next people, you are going to need to be around some people who have a lot of experience in these strategies, who have kind of been there before you, have seen how they succeed, have seen how they fail, who have done it for a lot of years. I'm a little worried about all the really successful real estate gurus who got into the business after 2011. Because I feel like they've only ever worked in an up market, and they're not prepared for, and they've been very successful, right? But they're not prepared for what happens when there's a recession and prices start going down. And it's good to have people who've seen that before, you know, who've been in up markets, been in down markets.
So you're saying it's good to have older, more mature people around you,
well,
on your team.
One older and one younger will also work. So, and also, like, the number of deals they've dealt with is important, because like Bill and I, between us, we have literally probably talked to 2,000 or 3,000 sellers about creative deals. Now, not all of those have worked, right? So sometimes sellers say no, right? But we've learned, like, why do they say no? Is there something I could have explained better that would have made them say yes? There have been times when they've said yes, and then we've gone back and done our due diligence and said, oh no, it's a no for us, because we found out something about the deal that we weren't expecting. Having people who've created the basic documentation, I am discovering more and more how important this is. I just, yesterday, closed my first participating loan. It's an equity sharing loan. Now, I knew how they worked, but knowing how they work is different than going to your attorney and saying, write this up. If you don't have documents to hand your attorney and say, I want it to be like this only, please fix it for my state, they don't know what to do with some of these crazy things, right? First time I tried to do a mortgage to secure option, my attorney said, you can't do that. And I said, oh yes I can, I've got paperwork. Just make it right, okay? And of course folks were willing to share these knowledge, experiences, and resources. Teachers are crucial. Bill, did you have teachers that taught you how to do this?
I did, and one of them is right back there, Pete Fortunato. But David Tilney's in the room, that's another. Dice Bottleford will be here tomorrow, he's another.
Oh, I love finding out that Pete's in the room when I'm speaking.
Just so you know, I saw when you said that the secret was people, I saw the man tear up. He had tears when you said that.
It's a little intimidating, just so you know. So yes, we both have had teachers, and we both continue to have teachers. We both still go to other people's seminars to learn how to hone this stuff, because how is she going to learn it? It's not like they teach it at college. Not like you can get any good information on sophisticated deal structuring on YouTube. I've watched some of those videos on subject twos. Please, please, please do not do what that guy is telling you to do. Oh my God. So there are 8 different ways to buy rentals with no cash or credit. There are 8 of them, and there aren't too terribly many people out there, and they're certainly not on YouTube, who have mastered all 8. And the important thing about knowing all 8 of them is that they give you more tools for your toolbox. So I'm gonna list them for you. Ready? Don't take a picture of the slide. Go ahead and do that. Number 1, owner carry backs. Owner has the house free and clear. He agrees to let you make payments instead of paying cash. Number 2, subject twos. We'll actually come back to that one. Number 3, lease options. Number 4, land contracts, also called contracts for deed in other parts of the country. If you don't know what that is, the example Kyle is going to give tonight at the 7:30 session is a land contract. Number 5, master leases. Number 6, wrap mortgages, which Dyke Spotiford is talking about on Sunday afternoon. And since a lot of what I know about wrap mortgages I learned from him, I would strongly suggest going to the source on that one. Creative private loans and joint ventures. Okay, so those are your 8 strategies where you can actually acquire or at least control a property without having to pull out a credit report or a bunch of cash. Now, there is a 9th thing, which is pure options. We talked about lease options, and we talked about master leases, which is a lease option without the option. There's also the option without the lease. Now, this is the reason I kind of put this in as a 9th thing is because this doesn't acquire you a rental now. It acquires you a rental 10 years, 20 years in the future, and it's usually not no money down. And we said we were going to talk about no money down strategies today. So that's an awful lot. How many of you saw at least one thing on that screen that you were like, I don't know what that is? Okay. Do you feel intimidated now? Are you like, I don't know, man. It's a lot of studying. There's actually a really good reason to know all of them, to be at least passingly familiar with all of them. And that is, they are different tools. Each one of those strategies has a different tax consequence for the seller. It has a different control consequence for you. Some of them you get the deed, and some of them you don't get the deed. So sometimes you don't care about getting the deed, and sometimes you're like, nope, I'm putting $70,000 worth of repairs in this house. I need the deed. So by knowing all of them, you can solve more problems for more people. Now, do you think you have to know all of them to go out and do some good deals? Absolutely not. If you know 1 or 2 of them, you can go out and do plenty of good deals. But when you know all of them, you can do more. So that brings us to the next set of people. And that's the sellers. We need to find people who have 2 things, a property and a problem. They need to have a property and a problem. Is somebody having a property they want to sell enough?
Nope.
No.
They need to have a property they need to sell or have a problem around selling, right? They also need to be open to creative solutions. Do you think every seller with a property and a problem is willing to even talk to you when you say, let's talk about payments?
No.
No. What do?
Thank you.
Thank you and go find the next seller, right? So Let's talk about Prater Drive again, and this time your job is to think about the seller and where the seller's mind was.
I want y'all to do me a favor. One of the most important lessons that we as investors can ever learn is this. Write this down. Our job as investors is not to buy, sell, and rent property. Our job as investors is to help people solve their real estate problems. The better you are at solving problems, the more successful you'll be.
I love it that you said write that down, and then you said an entire, like, two paragraphs.
It's recorded. You get the recordings from this event.
That's true.
So here's the story of the why. Because sometimes the why is more important than the how much. But if you're someone and all you're doing is wholesaling, if you're making those 70 cents on the dollar offers, and that's all you're doing, and that's the only tool in your toolbox is a big damn hammer, and that's the only thing you're working with, then you're going to miss a lot of deals. So in this case, the why. So the story behind it is the owner had owned this home for 1 year. They had moved about 10 miles away. This was their first house. They had an apartment before. Young couple, nice couple, had a couple kids. This was their first home, and they were very proud of it. And when they bought it, they liked the house. It was a three-bedroom, two-bath. It was a ranch. It had a two-car garage, nice lot, nice subdivision. And when I met them, they had a for sale sign in the yard. I knocked on the door. I know that's amazing that when you see a for sale sign that you would think that a homeowner, oh my God, would actually talk to you. But they invited me in. And when I talked to them, I found out that the mortgage balance on their mortgage was $73,000. So that's what they owed. But that's not the problem. What was really good, well, let's talk about the mortgage. So 8.5%. So, and how do I find this stuff out? Okay, so you have to know that when you're talking to sellers, think of a doctor. A doctor is going to ask you the hard questions, right? You have to be able to ask the hard questions, know what questions to ask, but you're going to have to ask the tough questions. And the situation is why they were selling their house, even though they'd only been there 1 year, is they had found the house of their dreams, their dream home. So the dream home, they put under contract. And let me tell you about the dream home. They were high school sweethearts. And they had lived in the same subdivision together. And they found a home in their subdivision where they grew up, where their family was, their friends, where they went to school. Everything that they knew and held dear was in this one big subdivision. And a house came available, and they wanted that house. And they went out and they could qualify for a mortgage. Even with their current mortgage in place, they qualified for a brand new mortgage. So that meant that they could go ahead and buy the house even before they sold their current house. Everybody got that? Okay, this is an important part. So they could buy the house before they sold it, but the situation was they were worried. Though they could qualify for two mortgage payments, what scared them? Someone tell me.
Two mortgage payments.
So they were worried about that. They got the house under contract that they were going to buy, their dream home, but using something called a contingency contract. Who's heard of a contingency contract before? Okay, so that meant that they did not have to buy the house they had under contract until when? Until they sold their home. Now, the person who was selling the house of the dreams, did they have to honor the contract to these new buyers? Yes. But did the buyers have to actually buy the house in the neighborhood of their dreams? Do you understand that a contingency contract is an option agreement? So realtors are going, we don't use options in real estate. You use options all the time. So they did a contingency contract. So what's the problem here? Someone tell me what the problem is. With them, what's the problem? What do they see the problem? Oh, and by the way, the contingency contract expires in 15 days. When I met them, 15 days, it expired. There's a backup contract in place. So the backup buyer would have stepped into the shoes and taken their home of their dreams.
Time?
What else? What were they telling me? Fear of what?
Fear of missing out.
What are they really scared of? The two? Say that. Two mortgage payments. The real thing was the two mortgage payments. They could qualify for the second mortgage, but they were scared of that. So they were terrified of that. So now they have a choice. They can sell their home now and get the house of their dreams, or not sell their home now and not get their house of their dreams. Have y'all ever been in a situation similar to that? Haven't we all? Raise your hand if you've been in a... We've all done that. We've all been there. We went, ah, what do I do? Okay, so what's the real problem here? What he said was the problem is two mortgage payments. That's the big problem. But what's the real problem? As investors, what's the real problem? Say it.
Lack of imagination.
He said, I don't want to pay two mortgage payments. I got to sell my house first. I can't pay two mortgage payments. What's he scared of? It's two mortgages.
Not finding a buyer.
But it's the two mortgage payments. That's what's really the problem here.
It's
the mortgage payment on the house he's selling.
You guys are all in the mindset of the seller, and you were repeating what the seller thought the seller's problem was. She's got it.
Who?
He doesn't want to make the payments.
He doesn't want to be responsible for the payments on the first mortgage, on the house that he's in now. If he could just not worry about having to make two payments and just make one payment, he could do this deal. But the only out he saw is, I must sell. Say it again.
Sub two.
He needs to get this house sold. But that's not really it. If he just had that first mortgage payment off his back, he can buy the house of his dreams and the neighborhood that he and his wife grew up in, where he wants to raise his children, where their moms and dads are. So, y'all help me here. And one person, very smart, already said it. But what deal structuring tool, what creative tool would you take out of your creative deal structuring toolbox where you could get the deed, where you could close quickly, where you didn't need a down payment, where you didn't have to qualify for the loan? What tool are we talking about? A subject to deal. So if the situation had been something different, would we have used this tool? No. We'd use a different deal structuring tool. But in this case, with what they said, we'll use this tool. So we agreed to buy this property subject to their mortgage. Now for the goddess.
So how many of you have studied subject twos?
Oh, a lot.
Well, yeah, but it's only like 30% of the room. That's interesting. Because this is maybe the most common creative deal structure that real estate investors do. And it looks really simple when you watch it on YouTube. It basically works like this, okay? You get the deed. So you go to the closing, the seller signs a deed that says he no longer owns it, you now own it. Everybody follow me so far? Yeah. However, there's already a mortgage on that house, right? The mortgage is the thing that says if the note's not paid, the bank gets to auction off the property to get their money back, right? Nothing changes about the mortgage. It still is sitting there attached to that property, even though the deed changed hands. There's a second piece, which is the note, right? That's the promise. I'm gonna pay you $533 a month for 30 years, pay this loan off. Right. That note was originated by the seller. It's still originated by the seller, even though you got the deed, right? So if you looked on the seller's credit report, you would see that they had this note that they had to pay. If you looked in the public record, you see there is this mortgage that was originated by the seller against the property, but you would also see that you are now the owner. Now, of course, the agreement that you are making with the seller is that after I get that deed, I'm going to make the payments. Right? That's the agreement with the seller. That's not an agreement with the bank. Bank doesn't know any of this happened. This is more than likely going to be the hottest strategy of the next 10 years. You know why?
Low interest
rate loans. 80% of the loans in the United States are at 4% interest or below.
Wow.
I know, that didn't sound like if I'd have said 4% interest a year ago, you'd be like, I got 2.75 when I refinanced my house, and now you're like, 4? Yes, please, 4! Current investor rates are 8 to 8.675. And let's look at what that does to your payment on your rental. If you were to take over a $200,000 loan that was, say, at 3.15% interest, the payment on that's going to be $1,380 a month. So think, $200,000 house, $1,380 a month payment, that's probably going to cash flow, right? At 8%, that payment is $1,988 a month. Plus taxes, plus insurance, plus maintenance, plus vacancy, plus management, right? Probably not going to cash flow. Same exact house, probably not going to cash flow if you got to go out and get a new loan on it. So subject two is the thing that makes this deal work for you, right? But what about the sellers? If you can't make the property cash flow at 8.8%, neither can anybody else. Homeowners who might want to buy this house to live in and could afford $1,300 but can't afford almost $2,000, they're not going to be buying, right? Not at $200,000. So the thing is, that's going to leave a lot of sellers sitting out there with $200,000 loans, especially ones that they got in the last 2 or 3 years and only paid 3% down on, finding themselves unable to sell that house for what they owe. Now, prices aren't dropping significantly, but they flattened out, right? A house that was worth $210,000 at the beginning of this year is probably still worth $210,000. That wasn't true last year. A seller who owes $200,000 on a house worth $205,000 cannot sell it conventionally because they can't pay the sales costs. They would have to bring money to the closing to pay the realtor, to pay the transfer tax, to pay the deed prep, to pay all of that stuff and pay off their loan, right? It's a bad position for a seller to be in. People do not like to pay to sell their houses. Sometimes do people have to sell their houses 2 or 3 years after they bought them? Yes. Absolutely. So do you think some of those sellers, when you said, I know your agent told you that you couldn't sell because you would have to bring money to closing, but I can give you your price by taking over your loan. Do you think there are some sellers out there who would think that was a wonderful solution for them? That's why I think that this is going to be the super hot thing over the next few years. Now, please do not run out and try and do a subject two based on the world's shortest lesson on subject twos. Bill and I gave a presentation here last year, and it was an entire hour and a half on nothing but subject twos and things like how to insure them and how to document them and the things that you need to know. There are other things you got to know before you go out and take a seller's deed and their payment book. You know, things like how do you explain it to sellers? Right? Like, how do you even talk to them? How do you do the due diligence on the loan you're taking over? Oh my God, please do not buy a house subject to a loan that you have not seen. Because, you know, sometimes sellers think their interest rate is fixed because it's actually adjustable. And interest rates have been so low for so long that their payment hasn't changed in a really long time. But it is adjustable, and it's going to go up 2% this year, and they don't even know it. Might that change your feelings about whether you wanted to buy that house if it could go up 2% this year and next year and the year after that? Because that's what most of those loans say. Yes. How to protect your seller from your potential default. Like, the biggest objection sellers have to subject twos is, how do I know you're going to make my payments? Because if you don't make my payments, whose credit gets ruined? Theirs, not yours, right? It's a legitimate concern. There's a way to hold title. It's called a seller protection land trust, where if you don't make the payments, they get the house back. No foreclosure, 45 days, no cost to them. They just get the house back. Would that probably settle most of their complaints about how do I know you're not? The reason you know I'm going to make your payments is because if I don't, you get the house back. Right. And I've never figured out how to make money giving houses back to sellers. There's seven documents that you need to have at closing, including a power of attorney, a detailed disclosure form so you can make sure they understand all the pros and cons of what they're doing. My microphone has just like disappeared off my ear here. There are three kinds of sellers you should never, ever, ever do a subject to deal with because you will ruin their lives. You will keep them from buying another house when they need to buy another house. Y'all are worried about the due on sale clause, right? Kevin's not. Kevin's like, nah. You know about the due on sale clause, right? It says if the seller transfers the property, the bank can call the loan due. Yeah, that's not actually fatal. There's like six things that you can do that are not just give the house back to the bank. So yeah, I mean there's more to know. Okay, just know that there is more to know. So seller's story on Williams. He told you the seller's story on Prater. Let me tell you seller's story on Williams. One of the ways in which Bill and I
back up the mic just a little bit.
Do what?
Pull the mic back a little bit, and I've got your water over here.
Thank you. One of the ways in which Bill and I are very different is he has always operated his business as kind of a solopreneur. If there's a deal to be found, Bill is going to go out and find it himself, like by knocking on doors. I prefer to have a lot of leads coming to me all the time so that I can kind of sift and sort through them and decide what I want to do with them. So this seller actually responded to a postcard that I had sent him, and called up and talked to my acquisitions coordinator, and this was the story he told. I want to sell my three family because I am a terrible, terrible landlord. He must have repeated some version of that 15 times in that phone call. One of the reasons I'm a terrible landlord is I have not raised rents on my tenants in 10 years. Another reason I'm a terrible landlord is because I am just at their beck and call all the time. Like if they call, I'm over at the property, and honestly, they don't do anything I tell them to do. I've got one tenant who has filled up the entire basement and the entire three-car garage, which was meant for all three of the tenants to have a parking place with this stuff. And I've told him to get rid of it, but I know I should evict him or something, but I haven't done it. I'm just terrible. And also his unit upstairs, the big three-bedroom, the most valuable one he had been vacant for 6 months. Because he didn't want to get over there and do the work on it, and didn't think he wanted to really own the property anymore. So 6 months of having no tenant up there, which meant he was losing money on the property every month. He then said, I need to get $170,000 for it because, that's always interesting when somebody says because. I owe $99,000. I already talked to my accountant, and he tells me there's going to be a $30,000 capital gains bill if I sell it. And I have a HELOC on my own house, and I would like to pay off half of that HELOC. So he just added those numbers together, and that was how he came to $170,000. Sometimes you run across sellers like this who their asking price has nothing to do with what the property might actually be worth, right? It's I need $45,000 because that's what an F-250 costs, right? Like that's the connection they make. Now, this one was a little unusual because the ARV on this house is actually $225,000. Okay. Yeah, it's usually the other way around. Usually they want to buy a $100,000 RV with the proceeds from their $70,000 house, right? This was a little bit the other way around. So you've heard what he told the acquisitions person. What is the real problem here?
Him?
Or at least his negative self-view. I'm a terrible landlord. He doesn't want to be a landlord.
He's losing money and time.
He's losing money.
Alligator,
he has this goal about partly paying off the one loan, and of course he's just a civilian seller, so he thinks the way to do that is sell the house for cash, right? Anything else? Any other problems here? He doesn't want it anymore. So here is what I heard. I heard the seller say loud and clear that if I don't have to manage this property anymore, and if I can get my payments made, and if I can stop losing money every month, I'm going to sell this house. Right? I know what he said, but that is what I heard. It really wasn't about the $170,000 to him. It was about this specific set of goals that he had for the $170,000. So, golly, if only there were some structure under which he would never have to deal with another tenant or another repair, and he didn't have to pay capital gains tax at all, and he could still get income and maybe also get $40,000 to pay back his HELOC. Wouldn't that be awesome if such a thing existed? What is that thing called? Okay, so you said master lease. And that is a strategy by which he could get rid of all of this stuff. But I like to own property, so yes, if I'm going to get a no money down, no credit deal, it's going to be a master lease with an option to buy. Everybody just shortens that up to lease option. Nobody ever actually says all those words. I got a master lease with an option. No, it's controlling a property with a lease option. So let's talk about how those work. You lease the entire property. This is a 3-unit. Which unit do you lease? All three. You have a lease on the entire building. You also have a right to sublease. Because obviously you're not going to live in all three units, right? So you have a right to have people who are paying you while you are paying the owner of the property. You also have a right to buy it at some point in the future that you agree upon at a price that you're agreeing on now. It's not, I'm going to buy it someday at whatever it's worth. It's, I'm going to buy it someday and let's agree on what that price is right now. Could be months later, it could be years later. Yeah, you all decide that with your sellers. So here's what I told this seller. I will pay you $1,500 a month, and now I will be your only tenant. And guess how many times I'm going to call you in the middle of the night and tell you that my toilet is overflowing? Zero. From that $1,500, you're going to make your principal, interest, tax, and insurance payment, right? I will take care of what are now my tenants. They are not your tenants anymore. They are now my tenants. I will take all the phone calls. I will take care of all the repairs and maintenance. But what I will not do is if there is a capital expenditure to be made, you're going to make it. So give me an example of what a capital expenditure would be. Thank you. A furnace. A roof. HVAC, yes. So anything that's going to last more than 10 years, okay? Why would I not want to do that kind of improvement? Not my house. And furthermore, I would probably, there's a chance that I might not buy the house. I don't have to buy it. I have the option to buy it, right? Now, because you are, Mr. Seller, renting the property and not selling it, guess what your capital gains bill is going to be? Zero. What's it been so far as you've been renting the property? It is zero. You will have to pay capital gains when I exercise my option, but I will give you 180 days notice before I exercise my option, and I will help you find the thing that you have already told me you would like to invest in next, which is something with a triple net lease that you never have to deal with a tenant for. Because I do eventually want to buy it, we'll have the lease, we'll have the separate agreement that says I have the right to buy it for the next 10 years for $180,000. Is that number different than what he said he wanted? Higher or lower?
Higher.
Why'd I make it higher? It's more enticing. You asked for 170, I'm going to give you 180, and I'll decide when. Sometime in the next 10 years, I'll give you $180,000. So I now have control of this building for 10 years with a $1,500 a month payment that never goes up. Will the rents go up?
Yes.
Yep. I also have the right to buy it or not buy it for the next 10 years for $180,000. It's worth $225,000 right now. Are the chances that it's going to be worth more than $225,000 10 years from now pretty good? There's one problem here we haven't solved, though, right?
$40,000.
He wanted $40,000 to pay off half that HELOC. How are we going to solve that? I'm not putting $40,000 down. I'll just tell you that right now. I'm not putting $40,000 down to control a house I don't own. Any idea how he could get $40,000? Yeah, so I said to him, I think your house is worth $180,000, obviously, because I'm offering you that. I think your bank is going to agree. And if you go to the bank and they agree, they will loan you 80% of that. That's $144,000. Now, this was late last year, so his interest rate on the loan he had, the $99,000 loan he had, was about 6.75. The interest rate he could get was about 4. So he's borrowing more money, but at a way lower interest rate and over 30 years. What do you think that might do to his payment? Actually lower it. So that $144,000, pay off your $99,000, it'll give you more money to pay down your HELOC than you were actually thinking. That will give you $45,000 instead of $40,000, and because your payment will be less, the $1,500 a month I'm going to pay you will be a $300 a month net profit, which is $300 more than you're making right now. Is that a pretty slick solution?
Yeah.
Every problem now solved. There's more to know about lease options, okay? I love doing them, but there's some very important documentation that you need to have along with your lease option. For instance, let's say that this seller turned out to be a bad guy. And I had this lease and I had this option, and unbeknownst to me, he got an offer for $300,000 and sold it to someone else. He has the title. He can sell it to someone else, right? You have to put documentation in the public record that shows your interest, and in fact, better than shows your interest, puts you in line as a lien against his property. Also, another important reason for that is, do people who are financially stable sometimes become unfinancially stable for some reason? It's often like an IRS lien, a car accident that they got a big judgment against them, and do the attorneys always attach those to the property? Is it possible that that could happen and he wouldn't be able to sell it to me for $180,000 even though he wanted to, because between his $144,000 mortgage and his $1 million IRS lien, he couldn't pay those off with my $180,000? So that's another reason to have this backup documentation in place. How about this? I send him $1,500. He's supposed to send $1,300 to the bank and he doesn't. Am I still going to be able to buy that house after the bank takes it through foreclosure?
No,
unlikely. So there are all of these things have moving pieces and practicalities, right? And here's another one that I discovered. You got to put some stuff in place in case your tenant doesn't pay their rent and you need to take them to eviction court. Eviction courts sometimes have problems with people who don't own houses evicting people from them. So there are always these things that you don't really get to know them until you've talked to somebody who's done a bunch of them and seen the problems, okay? So here is something that you may not have thought about so far, or maybe you have, and that is, we've given two examples of deals where the sellers were willing to sell no money down. What happens when they can't sell no money down because they really truly do need the money for something? Can you still do a no money down deal if the seller needs money down? Come on, you know the answer is yes. You could at least pretend to be teacher's pet here and be like, yes, Tina, I don't know how, but I'm sure that that can be done. Not all sellers can do these deals. Not all sellers will do these deals at all, right? And so sometimes you have to go back to the, what you call it, the big damn hammer offer. Okay, well, you don't want to do this. I can also pay you cash, but it's going to be a lower number, right? For both of those two reasons, there's another kind of people you need, and that is private lenders and partners. Private lenders and partners are people who actually have cash, who are willing to use it to finance your deals or to add money to your seller deals to make a down payment or to do repairs that the property needs. Now, private lenders and partners invest money for a different reason than a seller carries financing. A seller carries financing because he wants to be done with the property. Why do private lenders and partners put money into your deal? To make money, right? It's wonderful. You completely understand their motivation. All you got to do is agree how much money are we each going to make, right? They're wonderful people to work with. So sometimes, it's confusing enough that I gave you 8 strategies, right? Sometimes you have to use 2 of them in a single deal. That is called structure stacking. And here's an example of a real deal where that had to happen.
In the real world of real estate investing, especially creative deal structuring, rarely is it just a subject to deal or an owner carry or a master lease. It's usually 2 or 3 or 4 more tools being used at one. It's usually 2 or 3 or 4 more deals being structures tools being.
Are you having a stroke?
No. I speak all over the country, and usually I speak to a room of white guys who are 60 years old. Can I have all the women in here please stand up?
He got distracted by the women.
Do you know how good this is to see? And it's because of the woman right over here. Thank you all for being here. This is just great. And I love to see so many different people in here. This is great.
Yeah, keep doing that, Bill.
Okay, so a lot of times we use different deal structures to make a single deal work, and that's called structure stacking. Am I having a stroke?
Hey, okay, you're
on this deal. On this deal, a husband was transferred to Phoenix from Atlanta, from Marietta, and left his wife behind, his kids behind. Her job was to sell the property. The property needed some work, and the property was a little bit cluttered. And that was her job to get it ready. They hired a realtor, but the realtor was dogging on the homeowner and said, you know, how am I supposed to sell your house when it looks like this, when it needs this work to be done, when you have wallpaper on the wall, when you have all the toys just all over the yard and stuff? How are we supposed to sell your house for you? And the homeowner was not happy. And where was her husband?
There.
And where was she?
There.
Where were the kids?
There.
Where was the husband? And it was summertime, and the school's getting ready to start, and where did she want her kids?
Not there.
But she wanted them in Phoenix for the school system, so she needed to sell, and she's getting grief from the realtor. So she just wanted done. And though the house is worth about $160,000, she was willing to sell it to us for $136,000, so that's well below market, right? So we're really happy about this. So what's her problem? You got to focus on the seller's problem. Our job is not to buy, sell, or rent houses. It's to solve people's real estate problems. What's her real estate problem?
It's not ready to show.
She needs to have it gone so she can be with her husband. She wants the family back together. We all feel that way?
Yes.
Okay, so in this case, the property's fair market value was $160,000. The mortgage balance was going to be $61,000, and she was selling to me for about $130,000. Do you see there's equity here?
Yes.
There's a lot of equity here. The terms on her note were 30 years, 4%, $334 per month, principal and interest. How did I find that out? You have to ask. To verify it, what did I ask for? The note and the mortgage. I wanted to see her closing docs to make sure of all this. And I knew that this market, this house would rent for $1,100 because I work a very tight area. I know that area well. So what's my problem with this deal?
About $70,000.
Say it again? My problem is about $70,000. Exactly right. So the price I could buy this house for was $136,000. She agreed to a 72 deal because she wanted it done. And when you hear someone say, just take it, just take it. Would you please just take it? Make this go away. Please take this thing. One of the tools you may use is a substitute deal. Sometimes a master lease with an option is a better way to go. There's other tools, but that's what she was saying to me. So she agreed, just take it. So it was $61,000 first. There's a difference of about $75,000. So I did not have the $75,000 I was short, but was this a good deal?
Yes.
Was this going to cash flow?
Yes.
Do I want this property?
Yes.
Yes, but I'm shy of money. Anybody ever been there? All of us? Okay. So I turned to a private money lender. Not the bank. I turned to a private money lender and I said, you know, I need this property to cash flow. I need to borrow the money, but I need it to cash flow. And so here's how we structured the deal. The borrower agreed to an interest-only 30-year loan. Pretty good, huh? I say the borrower. I'm sorry. I'm the borrower, but the lender agreed to lend me at this. It's 3%. Who on earth? Why are you shaking your head? What's wrong with you? Do you have a thing with your neck? Why are you doing this? 3%. Because the payments are only $188. Isn't that a great deal so far? But we have to sweeten this thing. The lender needs more. So watch this. I agreed to give the lender 25% of the deal. In other words, 25% of the net rents that come in, the lender gets that. And one day when we sell this property, there'll be a profit, and the lender gets 25% of the profit. Do you see that the return is going to be much higher than if we loaned it 8 or 9% or 5% or whatever we did? So that's how this was structured. This is known as an equity participation loan or an equity sharing note. It has different names, but just remember, equity sharing, because I'm sharing some of the upside. I'm sharing some of the cash flow in this deal. Because is it better to have 100% of nothing or 75% of something good? So this is really a great way to be able to get a property where you have affordable monthly payments. So he agreed to interest only. The payments were low. Good cash flow coming in here. And where did the loan come from? His self-directed retirement account. So he's young. He can't even touch the money until he's 58 and a half years old. Right? He can't even touch the money. So it's okay because this money's going to be going into his account. It's a good investment for this young man. So this was good. We love this thing.
Okay, I want to introduce you to somebody.
Yes.
This is Andrea. Stand up, Andrea.
Andrea.
Andrea's a brand new investor.
Andrea, you're brand new?
Yep.
It's good to meet you.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry, Andrea. Andrea, you're a brand new investor. Did you just do one of these yesterday?
I did.
Woo!
I did. Cool.
Sorry.
It's you. It's all you, babe.
Okay, so that is an example of creative borrowing, right? When we think about private lenders, we think we pay 11% interest for 6 months, and then there's a balloon, right? That's retailer thinking. That's a really good way to borrow money if you're going to sell the property in 6 months. If you're going to keep the property for 30 years, you can't agree to 11% interest in a balloon. Just doesn't work, right? So there are creative ways to put together deals with private lenders where they actually get more of what they want. 3% interest, that kind of sucks, right? No one in here is going to be super anxious to loan money out at 3% interest, but would you do it for 3% interest and 25% of the back end that's likely to be a lot of money, or 25% of the monthly payments, which some months will be money and some months will not be money. You understand that, right? At 25% of the income, that's only when income is coming in. So what that did for Bill was it made the payment he had to make every month super low. And then in months when it was rented and he was doing good, he gave 25% of whatever the net rent was, not the gross rent, to the lender. And a lot of lenders like this a lot better than they like having to recycle their money every 6 months, having to go find a new loan every 6 months. They like the long-term thing and they like participating in what you are doing. However, please, 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 stop posting on Facebook that you're looking for private money and that you will pay X percent interest.
But you meet such interesting people
now. Yes, like officials from the Securities and Exchange Commission, for instance. That is completely illegal, guys and girls. How do you find people that you can talk to about loans like this? You build relationships, you network, you go to exchange meetings and haves and wants meetings, right? You don't put up bandit signs that say 12% interest. interest guaranteed and secured by real estate. Like, every word of that is illegal, and I have actually seen those signs here in Cincinnati, Ohio. You have to understand how you're legally allowed to approach and recruit these borrowers, and you need to know how to document the upside portion of the loan. We worked on that documentation for a week and a half, trying to really define, like, what is 25%? 25%, so are we going to withhold reserves? Yes, it's a rental property. We need to withhold reserves. That's not going to be part of the 25% unless the property sells, in which case, obviously, it's in the reserve account. She gets 25% of it. That is not all the people. We've talked about so many people, and that's not all the people. There's another set of people that you need around you, and we're just going to give them the name that Pete Fortunato gives them, which is allies. Allies are not necessarily folks who are going to give you money. They're not necessarily folks who have deals for you. They are people who want to help you, who want to help you succeed, and who, by the way, you want to help succeed too. One-way allyships don't last very long. You know, you're helping me, but I'm not doing anything for you. I don't care if you succeed or not. In this particular case, you need people around you who are out there trying these structures, have had some experience in these structures, and who are willing to help you work through particular deals as they come to you. Because you can learn from the book all day long, and then sure as shooting, your very first deal is going to have some twist to it that you're like, man, that wasn't in the book. I ran across one the other day. I was trying to help a student with a deal, and the deed was in the name of the widow. The mortgage was solely in the name of the deceased husband. And she hadn't bothered to open probate because they had a survivorship deed, and she just got the property. And so there was literally no one who could sign a request to the bank asking for the mortgage payoff. Right? So those are things come up like that you have to work your way through. And sometimes you need your butt kicked. Sometimes your allies say, look, you know, we've been talking about this deal now for a week. You just need to go make the offer and see if they accept it. Sometimes you need to get your butt kicked. So I will tell you that the ultimate allies are people who have graduated from the Ultimate Creative Deal Structuring Workshop. I know this because they have weekly support calls every Wednesday night. They get on the phone for an hour, and the only purpose is, if you're working on a deal, bring a deal. We will all mastermind it and come up with something, a couple of different ways that you could possibly do it, give you the advice that you need to have. Who in this room has taken advantage of that call? Look around you. These are smart people who also sometimes need help with their deals. It's a great, great group of people. And we're not actually done with the people. Like, even after you get the deal closed, first of all, you need a good closer who will help you get through this, right? You're probably going to need an attorney at some point to help you with wording the paperwork. You're going to need contractors to fix up your property for you. You're probably going to want to do some of these deals in your self-directed IRA, where those super high returns are not taxed, right? And one of your biggest people, if you're going to buy rental properties and make lots of money on it, is having good renters, right? Lots and lots of people everywhere. You understand? These deals are about people and your relationships with them. We'd like to provide you with some of those people. We would like you to join this community of Ultimate Deal Structuring Workshop graduates, because when you do, we can get you at least that first three or four sets of people. Number one, we can get you the teachers. That would be me and Bill. Although you can fast forward through Bill's part of the workshop if it bothers you. We did a three-day seminar back in February of 2022, so this is really, really fresh. We recorded the whole thing, video, tape, audio, and do we have one of the manuals?
You do.
I do, but I didn't bring it in with me.
Go to the bookstore and get one, because they need to see this brick.
In a box right behind the
that we
underneath
produce.
The table.
So this is going to be your stage one, right? This is going to be your getting the knowledge, you understanding what you're doing so that you can go out into the world and do it and benefit people. In this workshop, we taught how to find... So in other words, where are the sellers, where are the private lenders, and how to negotiate and how to document all eight of those strategies. Subject to seller-held mortgages, deals with partners, deals with private lenders, leases with option to buy, wrap mortgages, master leases, and pure options. Every single one. Now you see that was 3 days long. Took three whole days to get through all of that. You also get all of the forms and contracts that Bill and I use to do these deals. Now, this is actually important because Bill invests in Georgia. Georgia is a deed of trust state.
And has a great football team. Go Dawgs!
I invest in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, which are mortgage states. These deals actually work slightly differently in deed of trust states and mortgage states. So whichever one you are in, there's going to be an appropriate document that says, here's what Bill uses when he is doing a subject to, here's what Vina uses when she is doing a subject to, etc. So all the disclosures you need, that seller protection land trust I was telling you about, that pretty much takes away that objection with sellers over the subject to thing. Purchase agreements where we have written in sample language. Right? How do you say to somebody in a purchase agreement, here's this thing that we are going to do? You're going to get a firm understanding of how these things work, and if not, we're going to give you your money back. So you get the video recordings of the entire events, and you get dropped into those Wednesday night calls. So that you can start actually going out and doing deals and having a backup team to help you do that. Now, the folks who run the Wednesday night calls, that's Kevin and Anita.
Kevin and Anita's right there.
Kevin and Anita. They do have one request for you. Please read the manual or listen to the videos before you start getting into the calls and asking questions about how to put together a deal. They are not there to teach you how to do a subject to deal. That's what me and Bill do. They are there to help you make subject to deals happen. You can start this now, effectively, if you get the Ultimate Creative Deal Making Home Study course today. We also can give you lots and lots of ideas on how to approach sellers and private lenders. Now, again, Bill and I do that differently. That's why it's so interesting to go to this class.
I do it right.
He does it the slow way. And he talks a lot about how do you door knock? How do you go to people's houses and just door knock and say, hey, you know, any houses for sale in this area? I talk about the thing that actually works, which is direct mail marketing and how to handle those incoming calls and so on. We're going to give you the allies via that weekly support calls. And I've been saying give this whole time. Maybe give is the wrong word. Yeah. The Ultimate Creative Deal Structuring Home Study course is $1,297. It comes with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. I mean, if you take it home and you go through the whole thing and you decide sometime in the next 30 days, this is just not for me. Not interested. You send it back. We will give you back 100% of your money. Is that fair?
Yes.
Like, we know it works, but I mean, if you even decide, yeah, I think it works, but I don't want to do it, we will give you back 100% of your investment. And by the way, you're not going to carry the brick home there. I mean, hold that up. Yeah. That's the manual from the live class. We put it all online, including all the forms and contracts in editable templates. So you don't even have to, like, retype them. You can just fill them out yourself. We do have a summit special. Of course, everybody has a summit special because there's a lot of competition here for your money. Here is our summit special. If you get the Ultimate Creative Deal Structuring course, $897. That is a $400 savings over the actual cost of the course. But wait, there's more.
There's more?
If you sign up today, we are doing another Ultimate Creative Deal Structuring Live course here in this room on April 27th, 28th, 29th, and 30th. Yes, it is now 4 days long. 4 days long, because we decided that an even better way to teach this would be to have some opportunity to put deals in front of you all and let you structure them there where we were there to help you. So some example deals where you can sit with some of your colleagues and figure out, like, here was three offers that I could make on this under three different structures. I think I just said all this. More details in the class, and of course this gives you more time for relationship building. So ultimate grads, do ultimate grads do business with each other, not just advise each other?
Yes.
Yes, they do, because over time, you're on these Wednesday night calls, you start to build relationships with people. You got some money, they need some money, you make a deal, everybody is happy. If for the live event, you can add a spouse or partner. Like partner, you understand, the partner is not the guy sitting next to you that you have never met before, that you're like, hey, we could save some money by going to this thing together. Like, legitimate, we have an LLC together, business partner, that's who we're talking about here. You can add a spouse or partner today or anytime before the event for another $400, okay? So, you guys, you can all do this, I promise you. I have met people a lot stupider than any of you who are doing tons of creative deals. You're going to have our help, you're going to have help of the ultimate community, and of course you have 30 days to try it out and see, and if we are wrong, that you can, if you can't do it, you simply tell us, we'll cut off your access to the recordings and the online information, and we will refund 100% of the investment. So you can do it, and the reason you can do it today is you will not see a cheaper price on this. Like, our early bird price on the 2023 event is $997, and those people don't get the 22 manual. You will not see a better deal than the one you are seeing right now, and there is not a better time to do this. I have never met anybody who said, boy, I wish I'd learned this stuff later. What I always hear is, man, I wish I'd have known this stuff for the first 10 years that I was in the real estate business. It is a great time to do it, and it is a great time in the market to know how to do this, because there are going to be a lot more sellers with problems coming at you over the next 12 months, and having these extra tools to help them out will help you out as well. So, Bill and I are going to go to the back room, answer questions, let the AV folks move on to the next folks. Come on back to the back, get yourself signed up. We want to work with you all. In fact, everybody who signs up is also going to get Bill's phone number.
So, thanks much.